KALW.
Part of my methodology of putting stuff away here is to look at every object I have and think to myself, where would I look for this right now?
Today, the former host of MythBusters and Bay Area local Adam Savage talks about building a career around special effects design.
To me, I define making as anytime you reach out with your point of view and make something that didn't exist.
Then we go to West Oakland to meet tinkerers and makers who keep old industrial machines from losing their steam.
There's a big difference between the fashion craze of steampunk and our existence as steam dorks.
And for Transgender History Month, we're revisiting a story about identity. That's coming up. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Special effects designer Adam Savage uses his imagination and mechanical skills to bring his ideas to life. The former host of the hit show MythBusters educated and entertained fans with wild experiments, like blowing up a cement truck or escaping from a car underwater. These days, he's sticking to less dangerous projects. Adam is co-producer of Silicon, which is more than your typical comic book convention. There's pop culture and a twist of innovation. KALW's Janae Darden spoke with Adam, who was at his secret workshop cave in the Mission District.
Adam Savage, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's funny, I used to watch you on MythBusters. I used to be like, that guy is either crazy or brilliant. And I never thought I would talk to you. So
I hope you didn't burn down anything too expensive.
No, I did not. I did not. I always watched you as a cautionary tale of do not do this at home. Always.
That's hilarious.
So I know you're from New York, and I know, I think I read your father worked on Sesame Street.
My father was one of the first animators hired to generate animated content because Sesame Street was initiated as to be one-third puppets, one-third live action, and one-third animation. And they did animation spots as the interstitials between other segments. And my dad did about 50 or 60 of those over my childhood in the 70s.
So now, of course, when we think of you working with your hands, putting things together, taking things apart, blowing things up. So what made you, like, what was something that you saw that really sparked your passion to want to create?
Well, the first thing that I saw was the example that my father set moving around the house. He was a complicated man in lots of specific and general ways, but he was a maker. And an experimenter, and he was not afraid of trying stuff that didn't work. And so that was the water we swam in growing up. He built the back deck on our house three different times, and my joke is he got it right by the last time. But the other joke in our family was that everything my dad did to improve the house immediately looked like it had been there for 20 years because he had this way of working that sort of integrated stuff. And, you know, I was always immersed in a house that was a work in progress. And so, you know, his studio was this wonderful playland for me where my first materials were cardboard and masking tape and the acetate, the clear plastic sheets that he used to animate on. And then later when I was, you know, showed a proclivity, they took me to all the summer art classes that I could stand. Well, look, my father did those animations for Sesame Street with a specific goal in mind, which was he did them in a concentrated 2 or 3 month period every year so that he could spend the rest of the year painting. And his whole life was designed around spending as much time as he could in his studio alone, painting the paintings he wanted to paint. And he didn't really even show them much while I was a kid. So I grew up with this austere example of somebody who dedicated their lives to something that was important to them.
Yeah.
You know, that it had a real value that he did this exploration. And he didn't talk about it a lot. It was just, again, like I said, part of the water I grew up swimming in.
The cave.
Yeah.
Which you're coming to us from is secretly located in the Mission, right?
Yes. I think most Mission locals know where the cave is and they keep it a nice secret.
Okay. So I've seen the cave. You've given us tours online. And I feel like when I see it, it's a science lab, it's a workshop, it's an artist loft, it's a museum. Like, it's just so many things. It might be your brain to some extent.
Extent. That's exactly what it
is. Okay. How do you find things? Because there's so many things in there. How do you find, is it organized chaos?
It is organized chaos. I like to describe myself as a high functioning hoarder. Mm-hmm. You know, my methodology for finding stuff, because finding things is really important to me. Actually, very recently, Mel Brooks' production company called me up because they're working on History of the World Part 2, and they wanted a prop from me. They wanted to borrow a specific prop that they saw that I had in one of my videos. And I was amazed that within like 3 minutes of getting that call, I hadn't looked at that prop in 10 years. I walked to a place where I expected it to be, and it was actually right there. And part of my methodology of putting stuff away here is to look at every object I have and think to myself, where would I look for this right now? What would be my first thought about where I'd look for this? And then I put it there. I try never to overthink it. I try never to be clever. Mm-hmm. And that helps me know that the next time I have that question, where's that light bulb? My answer will be, well, where would I look for it? Okay, I look for it there. That's hopefully where I put it. And usually that's the case.
How does, you know, living in the Bay Area, how does that influence you as an artist and as a maker?
Oh, I love that question. You know, I moved here 32 years ago from New York City. I didn't know it then, but what I understand now, what was happening was I was in New York for 5 years, but I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life. And another way of saying that was I didn't know what my ambition was. Mm-hmm. Manhattan, New York City is the worst place in the world to be if you don't know what your ambition is.
Interesting, really.
I think of cities like New York and Los Angeles as cities for people with ambition. And I think they're highly competitive cities in all of the industries that they partake in. And that yields some really rigorous work. But I didn't know what my ambition was, and New York isn't going to spend a lot of time helping you figure it out.
That makes sense.
But I had visited San Francisco, and what I felt here after I moved here and still feel here today is a very different kind of city in which the threshold to entry to try flying your freak flag and try the artwork and the performance and all the other things you want to do is much easier here. And so, you know, I came out here, I fell into a job in the theater industry, which led peculiarly to working in commercial special effects, which was an industry I had been trying to crack into for half a decade. And I didn't get into it until I stopped trying. And it was the Bay Area that gave me the wonderful experience in theater to realize that, yeah, this was something I was particularly suited for, making things with my hands and solving weird problems with props and constructions.
I know, you know, people watched you for years on Mythbusters, and, you know, you worked in theater, you worked on films, and Mythbusters, you did some very interesting things, crazy things, wild things, dangerous.
Yeah.
Are you still doing dangerous stuff?
You know, no. I mean,
okay.
You know, I ride my one wheel around the Mission and around San Francisco. That's not entirely the safest occupation. I ride it slow because I'm older and things are more brittle than they used to be. You know, it's funny. Mythbusters taught me that I am not an adrenaline junkie. I do
really?
Not. Yeah.
Really?
I do not like.
Wait, weren't you on for like 14 seasons?
We were. I mean, I put myself in a lot of situations that were dangerous, but our goal was always to design the experiments so that kind of anyone could have done it, that it didn't require some special skill or mental frame of ours. We really tried to make the safety so that if we asked somebody random on the crew to do it, they would be just as fine.
Well, something more safe, but also fun. It's Silicon.
Yeah.
That's coming up. And in 2019, you became the host, creative director, co-producer of Silicon. You know, and now your name is attached to it.
Yeah.
So now it's like Silicon with Adam Savage. So what are you bringing to the con that's different than other cons?
Well, you know, every con sort of finds its niche. I think we all agree that San Diego is the industry con. It's the 800-pound gorilla of cons. And I think that a lot of people who are familiar with cons think of Dragon Con as the cosplayers con, right? That's the deep cosplay experience. And we want Silicon, my goal of Silicon is that it's the makers con. You know, one of the things that has been lovely enjoying making Mythbusters for 14 years was that it came to fruition about the same time as the maker movement was ascendant, and also rapid prototyping, rapid manufacturing, 3D printing, laser cutting, all of those were also ascendant. And cosplay became a cultural phenomenon all within this same period of time since 2000. Mm-hmm. And with the cosplay community, I noticed immediately a real resistance to gatekeeping. An egalitarian welcoming for the most part. There were still a few outliers here and there, but for the most part, the community was like, we share everything. We give it away. We want you to have our patterns. Let's all celebrate these narratives together. And I love that. It is a deeply maker ethic. It is a deeply cosplay ethic. And it's my ethic, right? My ethos. So we're dedicating, I think, almost 20% of the floor of the con to a maker space. We're going to have benches with lamps and tools and boxes of stuff you can just grab and stuff you can buy to make stuff. There'll be contests and workshops all weekend long. There'll be people like my friend Fawn Davis, one of my old colleagues at ILM, and he runs Fawn Co. out of LA, a special effects studio. Fawn will be doing some panels in the making of things and model making, you know, and to me, I define making as anytime you reach out with your point of view and make something that didn't exist.
Right. And I know you cosplay, and you gave a really great TED Talk several years ago about cosplaying. I really encourage people, if you don't know much about cosplaying or if you just want to know more, just to watch that video. What's the joy you have from cosplaying and seeing other people, you know, cosplay?
Oh,
especially at Silicon, too.
Yeah. It's hard to cosplay.
Yeah.
It's difficult. Almost every costume is sweaty. There are very few that aren't. And when they cover your whole body and face, they're always uncomfortable. But there's a sympathetic magic in pouring your own body into a narrative or a concept that means something to you. And that magic is diving into your own inner workings and taking a look at them. I'll tell you, when I came off the TED stage from that talk on cosplay, and giving a TED talk is one of the, like I've spoken to 200,000 people at once on the Washington Mall. So I'm not afraid of stages, but when you're standing on a stage and there's 3,000 people in the room and Steven Spielberg's in the front row, it gets a little intense. And I came off that stage, I wasn't sure how the talk went, and a big celebrity, I won't name them, but they're a hero of mine. They came up to me after the end of that talk and they said, look, I just want you to know I've never understood fan culture. It's never made sense to me and it's always creeped me out a little bit and I've always kept it at a distance. They said, but your talk helped me understand it. And what I think they meant was they understand as an actor how putting on a costume can change what's going on. And I was expressing that cosplay is the exact same process. And I like to imagine that, you know, when we go to a con and we dress up, we are exploring ourselves. We are looking into our own souls and wondering what about these narratives mean something to us. And I think that is an important conversation to have with ourselves. And I think it foments real critical thinking with each other.
What advice do you have for people who want to start doing some of the things you're doing, making, designing?
You know, I think that the first thing I would tell people who are new to making things and designing is to recognize that you are vulnerable when you show your stuff to people. And it can be very difficult when you show your stuff. If you don't make stuff and your friends don't make stuff and you try something, you show it to them and they're like, that looks crappy. That can be one of the more heartbreaking moments. And everybody involved doesn't realize that they're creeping up on a heartbreaking moment. It wasn't the friend's intention to crap all over the thing that someone made. And yet, real vulnerability happens when you do that. So I like to point out to people, if someone craps on your work and makes you feel bad, don't show any more work to them. That's not your problem. That's their problem. And when you find a community that is thrilled by what you're doing and encourages it, that's the community to gravitate towards.
That was special effects designer Adam Savage speaking with KELW's Janae Darden. That interview was produced with help from Porfirio Rangel. Silicon with Adam Savage is happening August 27th and 28th at the San Jose Convention Center. You can find all the details at KELW.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Henat Baba. Now we'll go from Adam Savage's secret cave in the Mission to a warehouse tucked away behind a metal scrapyard in West Oakland. Kinetic Steamworks is an industrial workspace for people to tinker with old machines. Here, a mishmash group of engineers, artists, and hobbyists work to bring back the lost art of steam power. Reporter Sarah Tan went to find out more in this audiograph segment from 2017.
I'm not trapped in a train engine right now, but it sure feels like I could be. I'm surrounded by large gears, metal pistons, and billowing clouds of hot, wet steam. Tucked away in a warehouse behind a metal scrapyard is Kinetic Steamworks. It's an industrial space for people to tinker with old machines in West Oakland. A mishmash group of engineers, artists, and hobbyists gather here every weekend to bring back the lost art of steam power. In the 19th century, steam was used to power boats, trains, pretty much anything that could be run by a pulley and a wheel. But by the early 20th century, it fell out of use in favor of diesel fuel, which was cheaper and more efficient. But it's still used in some places. Steamworks member Troy Welch tells me.
Now steam is happening in power plants. You just don't see it. They're giant steam turbines, and they're still what makes, you know, most of this country go.
In fact, over 90% of electricity generated in power plants is created using steam power.
Steam is part of our history, whether or not, you know, America recognizes it or not.
Troy says their group was founded as a way to get more people excited about working with steam power.
But the demographics, unfortunately, you see a lot of these guys, a lot of them are getting older, a lot of them are passing away. You know, the founders sort of wanted something different than that. They didn't want an old steam group. They wanted something where you could engage younger people and artists. And so they said, let's do something unique. Let's take steam and mix it with art.
And so in 2005, Kinetic Steamworks was born.
And then next thing you know, everybody was sort of hooked on steam.
That's Steven Rademacher, a plumber by day and weekend steam enthusiast.
That's very leaky.
Why is it leaking? Should we get a wrench on it or something?
Today, Steven and Troy are working on the group's main steam engine.
We call this engine Roy, and it's been a real runner for us.
Roy's about 5 feet tall. He's got two long, thin metal pipes curving around the top that draw steam in and let water out. At the base is a metal wheel, and above that, a couple metal gears and pistons pump furiously. Roy is used as a power source. They'll hook his steam-powered wheel up to gears that might turn a pencil sharpener, or power a vibrating couch, or play keys on a piano. There are lots of projects people work on here, but the biggest one, a fully restored steam-powered printing press. It's the size of a small boat.
My grandfather used to work on the railroad back in the day, so I've always had a love of mechanical things.
Member Marcia Hurst is a nurse during the day, but she says she's always been passionate about machines and figuring out why they work, which is why she joined Kinetic Steamworks 6 years ago.
I'm kind of an amateur artist, so that kind of, I can contribute sometimes with artwork. And then I also have one of these presses.
For her, Kinetic Steamworks is like science and art coming together. She's helped refurbish an old printing press, and now she uses the press to make prints.
Yellow, magenta, cyan, and black.
Marcia says it's important that people can see the engines with all their parts moving, something you can't always do with other machines like your iPhone or computer.
I think there's something really powerful and great about understanding exactly how something works. And I also think it inspires people to maybe be a little more creative and realize we've gone from this to what we have now. You know, that there's so many possibilities of what you can do.
So members really see steam power not just as nostalgia for the past, but as inspiration for the future. Which is why Stephen Rademacher says,
we're not steampunks, we're steam dorks.
No top hats, goggles, or any other Victorian clothing here.
There's a big difference between the fashion craze of steampunk and our existence as steam dorks.
Steampunk is all right, he says, but steam dorks? They get the wheels turning. In West Oakland, I'm Sarah Tan for Cross Currents.
That story first aired in August 2017, and you can find more Audiograph segments online at KELW.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Last year, San Francisco became the first city in the country to recognize August as Transgender History Month. So all this month, we'll be sharing stories highlighting the experiences of people we've talked to over the years. Today, we're looking back at a short personal essay that Skylar Crownover sent over to us in 2013, back when they were a student at Mills College.
As I stand in the bathroom, hands soapy under the hot water, I can feel their eyes burning holes into the back of my head while they try to decide what might be between my legs, as if it's any of their business. I have never understood this impolite and intrusive behavior that has followed me throughout life. When did society deem it okay to recheck the sign on the door when you walk in and see me, or to directly say, I think you're in the wrong bathroom? There has been no change in the force with which this question hits me as it repeats itself at 7, 10, 15, 18 years of age. In a society that insists bathrooms are based on biological sex, you are not allowed to ban me based on my gender. I wish I could say that this was uncommon, that these were isolated events, isolated to me. But bathrooms pose an incredible challenge to transgender and gender nonconforming people. When I was 10, I used to sneak into the men's bathroom because it was easier. In the men's bathroom, I wasn't questioned. It was freeing. But that is no longer a safe option, so I am forced to endure the accusing, disgusted looks. Bathrooms are not the place for society's microscope. A little privacy, please.
That was Skylar Crownover in a piece that first aired in 2013. It's nearing the end of the show, so let's hear some music from a Bay Area band. This is Tiffany Austin. She'll be playing in Oakland this Saturday at the Sound Room.
It was 40 below.
She flew straight to the tangible. Today's Cross Currents team includes Sebastian Mino Buccelli, Sunday Holland, James Rowlands, Gabe Graben, Victor Tenz, Shirin Adil, Lisa Morehouse, Shia Levitt, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.